Today, my interview is with, or my conversation is with Dr. Matthew Jebb from the Botanic Gardens. He's the director of Botanic Gardens. So good morning, Dr.
Good morning, Lakshmi. Jebb.
Yes, good morning. You were saying that you were in Australia recently. Was it recently?
Yes, in October. I was there for a fortnight up in Cairns, in Queensland.
Yeah, and you didn't see the fires there?
No, actually, Queensland was still just coming into out of a late spring, so it was fairly cool. There were occasional showers, but, you know, summer was just beginning, and summer had arrived a lot earlier down in Victoria and New South Wales.
Oh, and could you tell us a bit about, since you're a botanist and expert at this?
I mean, firstly, Australia is enormous. It's a very, very big country. It covers essentially the whole of Europe, if you were to transplant Australia on top of Europe. It's a very large place with a lot of different climates.
Yes.
So up in the extreme north, in Northern Territories, very much desert with savanna, which is a vegetation type with just occasional trees scattered on a landscape that's otherwise open. But in northern Queensland, there is rainforest. It is ever wet, the climate there. So one has rainforest that is very similar to New Guinea, this huge island just to the north of Australia. And as one travels further and further south, again, it becomes more savanna-like, full of eucalyptus. And down in the extreme south of Australia, again, it is desert, the famous Nullarbor Desert, which literally means no tree desert, Nullarbor.
Aha. Uh-huh. So that's an Aborigine word, is it?
Yes. There's all sorts of Aboriginal words that are used, like we use didgeridoo, kangaroo, and so on. But some of these other names are very classical terms imposed by colonial views of a land that, in their opinion, had no names as yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, the Aborigines have been living there for 40,000 years. Is that correct?
And what is remarkable about them is the entire island of Australia was still populated by nomadic peoples, which is unusual on the earth, because normally we have settled people who take up agriculture, build larger and larger settlements. When Europeans first came upon Australia, it was still populated entirely by nomadic tribes who were subsisting off the landscape. And it was a very, very hard landscape. In fact, a lot of people say, you know, human beings really ecologically can't live on Australia unless they have this subsistence hunter-gatherer lifestyle.
Mm. Is that why they walked about?
Constantly on the move. You're right. If you make a settlement, you can run into problems that in a dry year you find yourself with no water.
Mm.
And you need, therefore, to match your movement across the landscape with the seasons. And the Aboriginals were able to impose a lot of their tribal histories and so on with the so-called dream time, where the myths of how the world was created, but also the memories of their tribes, were fixed upon the landscape in this remarkable way that as they walked, they recited their histories to their children. And those children, as they grew up, would in turn pass it on to their children in turn. So it was a wonderful way of, for a group of people that didn't have a settled lifestyle, didn't have buildings full of objects, were able to use the landscape instead as their aid memoir to their tribal histories.
So as they were walking about, they call it a walkabout, isn't it? Each young person becomes a man by living alone in the outback, is it? Called the outback?
Yes, out in the outback. And you're going walkabout is something that's a very important part of their cultural transformation from childhood to adulthood. Going walkabout, really living off the landscape. It's a bit like our own mythologies of Europe, of people going and leading a life out in the desert. For example, Christ spent a month fasting and living out in the desert. This is a way to really get in touch with nature.
Yes.
And living in tune and in balance with nature is something that was very important to their cultural utilization of that landscape.
It also probably it helps people to know where things are as they are walking about. They can tell their tribe, or they learn how to live in this difficult landscape. They know where the water is, but how to exist when there is no water. Am I right?
And also where food might be got. I mean, a lot of the food, the in the form of gathered plants and so on, they're very, very toxic plants.
Yes.
And what you have to have is the knowledge of how to process them. So these big roots will be full of cyanide, and you have to know that you can bake it first or boil it, and then you must grate it up. Mm. You must dry it to allow the cyanide to evaporate. And then when you finally cook it the second time, it's perfectly wholesome food. But that knowledge is hard won. It's something that has required generations of utilization of these resources and the passing on of that knowledge. And likewise with sort of medicinal plants you can make ropes, bits of string from, bows, arrows, and of course the famous boomerang, that the a way of hunting the big marsupials, the kangaroos and so on, involved a throwing stick that would come back to you.
Yes.
So it was a wonderful way of throwing something after something, and if it missed, it would circle in the air and land close to your feet so that you could have another shot.
When you're saying that, I'm just thinking, when for the white settlers, it must have been very difficult.
There's a certain brutality about Western domination of landscapes where you can use technological advantages of firearms, for example, guns and weaponry. But when it comes down to it, being able to plant a crop and harvest it was something that those settlers found incredibly difficult because there is a climate in Australia that's quite unlike anything they were used to in Europe. So as Europeans going out there, they would have had the familiar idea of the four seasons, winter, spring, summer, autumn. But in Australia, there's something very different operating. There's a very, very lengthy summer. And what is intriguing is a lot of the indigenous tribes there have more than four seasons. They have up to six seasons. They recognize an early spring, a late spring, an early summer, a late summer. And so these are very additional, and imposing this year of four seasons was probably one of the biggest mistakes the European settlers made, because they realized that growing crops in huge parts of Australia was completely impossible.
So is there, where there are fires now, are there a lot of crops there? What kind of crops do they grow there?
Well, the clearance of a lot of land involved growing grain crops and so on, but those are dependent upon enough water landing through the growing season. And essentially, Australia does not have that. In some places, it does. So down in the extreme south, in Victoria and so on, there's large wine-growing areas, grain crop-growing areas. There's sufficient grass to raise sheep. But up in the Northern Territories, it's so dry and sparse, the vegetation. The only thing you can raise, really, is buffalo.
Oh,
so they range buffalo. And on these ranches, they might have 1 million head of buffalo.
What kind of water buffalo?
Water buffalo.
Oh, right.
Because ordinary cattle from Europe just can't tolerate that heat.
Yes, but they need water.
They do as well. Yes. So there are various creeks and so on. But the amount of rain that falls on average in Australia, it's barely 35, 40 centimetres a year. So it's a very small rainfall. And it also suffers from another extraordinary phenomenon referred to as El Niño. Yeah. El Niño references the Christ child, and it's a word that comes from the Spanish settlers in South America, because there's a seasonal shift across the entire Pacific, and it takes about 4 years. But what happens during an El Niño, which comes around the Christmas time in South America, is the climate cools. A lot of the crops, like the anchovies off the coast, disappear, and rainfall increases. Whereas on the opposite side of the Pacific, an enormous heat wave develops. So essentially, Australia goes through a heat wave every 4 to 5 years. And then this varies again over every 40 odd years. It becomes very, very intense, and then it becomes very relaxed. So there is something beyond an annual season. It's a four-yearly shift in the climate.
It's amazing. I mean, I wonder how these settlers, early settlers, I suppose they didn't go into those areas. They probably chose different places to settle.
A lot of times they didn't understand what these things were. Around the coast, you've always got sea fish and fish, so on. So you've got resources there. But inland, in the sort of dry, deserted, centre of Australia, it's fantastically hot, dry, and lacking in vegetation.
So in this area that where the fires are, I'm sure people from Ireland have gone and settled in these areas as well. So they must be wondering what's happening to their relations.
Well, I think, yes, people have been quite shocked at the speed with which this has come upon Australia. Over the last 3 years, there's been a very constant drought. So whilst people have understood that there's been this long-term drought, and whilst every year there are bushfires in Australia,
yes,
the intensity this year, and that the fact that the fires are coming right into urban centres, so on the outskirts of Sydney and other big cities, there have been devastating fires, is due to this long-term sort of three-year drought now that has hit Australia. And it's a long-term trend that rainfall has dropped by more than 10, 15% in a lot of areas of Australia. And the landscape is so dry, the wood, the dried grass is just waiting there for ferocious fires. And the speed at which these fires is moving is really horrific.
It's like tinder waiting to be, yes. Yeah. So what do you think could you stop this devastation? How can people help?
The only way it can be stopped, and all the firefighters know it, is when rain comes. And luckily in the last week or so, there's been, a slight shift. There has been increasing rain, but, it's the height of summer there still.
Yes.
They are not expecting heavy rainfall for many, many months yet. And in a way, nobody can predict what's going to happen other than that there is slight relief at the moment that small amounts of rainfall, cloud cover, means that landscape is not as dry as it was.
So how do people live in this area before this drought?
They were never able to, and that was the simple fact that the Aboriginal peoples of Australia remained as nomads for the 40 millennia that they've been there. That there was no opportunity really to settle down and grow crops in one area, because every few years such devastating droughts would hit that you would have to move elsewhere. And no so-called civilization can develop in one spot unless it has got predictable seasons. And that's not to say that Aborigines lacked a civilization.
No.
They had their own specific civilization entwined with the landscape. So they were people who lived off a landscape and knew how to treat it appropriately.
Actually, that's something that I was thinking. I wondered, well, where are the Aborigines? I don't see anybody there. It's usually people who are settlers that you see on television. Or are there any Aborigines there?
There are, but in many places they have been swept off the landscape. I mean, the colonial history of Australia is an appalling blot on the history of the world, that they were treated incredibly badly. They were divested of their lands, and anything that was good in the way of a water hole or a supply of water, yes, became a magnet for settlers wishing to establish cattle ranches and so on. So these people were driven off the land. And in some cases, there was, you know, positive genocide carried out to clear people from Tasmania.
Because they
Tasmania.
Needed water.
Tasmania, for example, which is a much more temperate climate.
Yes.
The Aborigines were literally hunted out by sheep farmers.
Right. They have sheep there as well?
Yeah, in appropriate areas. So again, yes, in Tasmania, that was, you know, you can grow a good crop of green grass. In fact, you know, travelling across Tasmania, anybody from Ireland is amazed that they will pass places like Glasnevin and they'll say, what? How come that has happened? And that's an indication of the number of Irish settlers who moved to Tasmania carried all those names with them.
Mm.
But, you know, today, yes, they have gone. And the last Aboriginal sort of leader was known as King Billy, King William of Tasmania. And, you know, he died as the last living Tasmanian
leader.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yes. You've given us another side, another picture of Australia, and thank you very much for doing so. I was always wondering, what's the other side of the story? And how did people live there for so long?
It's a beautiful landscape. Yes. One of the extraordinary things about going into the outback in Australia is how vivid the colours are.
Mm.
The soil is red. Where there is a tree or shrub, it is vivid green, and the sky is as blue as you will see anywhere. So the intensity of those colours, the clarity of the air, it's a very beguiling landscape.
And it's depicted in the picture, you know, the art of the Aborigines.
Yes. Exactly, those strong colours.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lakshmi.
Thank you.